The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 020730, excess underwriters at Lloyd's versus Frank's Casing Crew and Rental Tools from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. Justice Brister is not sitting in this cause. Docket number 040933, the City of Grapevine, Texas versus Amy Sykes and Tana Trevino-Waddell from Tarrant County and the 2nd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 030914, Hyundai Motor Company versus Victor Manuel Vasquez and Brenda Suarez Vasquez from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green and I are not sitting in that cause. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete all three of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 020730, Excess Underwriters versus Frank's Casing Crew.
May it please the court, Mr. Clifton Hall will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please report? I'm Cliff Hall, and there's been quite a lot written about this case in the opinion since the court issued it in last year, and it's been a bit of a challenge to decide which of those issues that have been raised to come here and talk to you about, especially with the time, and I'm sure you have your own individual ideas as to what you want me to talk about, but if it was left to me, there's four main things I want to cover today. First is that the court has not, in the Frank's Casing opinion, created a new right of reimbursement that does not exist in an insurance policy. I think that what happened and what the court did in Frank's is recognize what it had previously recognized is a right that insurers have to litigate coverage, and that under the circumstances of the Frank's case, that right was not lost merely by virtue of a demand and an insurer acceding to that demand and settling or funding a settlement that is insured and agreed. Second thing I want to talk about is the conflict or the alleged conflict that Franks creates for defense counsel, because I think that argument is illusory. I don't believe that it changes the duties and responsibilities of defense counsel in any way. I think defense counsel can act as they have acted in the past in handling these cases. Third point that I want to address is that there's a whole bunch of arguments that I think fall under the heading of insurance companies are bad, insurance companies are evil, and insurance companies can't be left to their own devices or left to be dealt with like everybody else is dealt with, and therefore we need to constrict the ruling in Frank's Casing and constrict the ability of insurance companies to act. I think that the response to that is that's not what happened in this case in the first instance, but Justice Heck said in the penultimate paragraph of his concurrence was, we're not saying that insurance companies can act with prejudice to their insureds. We're not saying insurance companies don't have the obligation to act in good faith. And if they don't, there are plenty of remedies that are available to deal with those insurance companies. And then the last thing I want to address is why I believe that Frank's is good policy and that Frank's Casing will result in the right kind of things happening in the handling of these cases and will result in ultimately the party that either that the determination of who pays will be made as a result of the determination of whether or not there's coverage under a policy.
Will it result in lower premiums?
Well, I think it results in a more free marketplace, which I think tends to result in lower premiums.
Isn't that a job for the insurance commissioner by contract?
What is that, Your Honor? Job?
Well, there's an argument made that the insurance companies are going to get a windfall because reimbursement has not been the norm until Frank's casing. And now if they can recoup these monies, that there should be a decrease in premiums, and isn't that highly regulated here? And in Matagorda County, we said, put it in the contract and let the premium fall out accordingly.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. One, in the excess and surplus lines market, which is what this case arises under, it's not a homeowners, auto, personal lines of insurance, which is what is highly regulated by the state. It's the excess and surplus lines market, which is a market where larger assureds, more sophisticated assureds that have more difficult problems that don't fit into the ordinary sort of book of business. The state of Texas, as indeed every state, I believe, has recognized that they're not going to regulate an excess and surplus lines market like they do with a homeowner's personalized type of insurance.
So all the easier then to put it into the contract.
Well, let me address that in this way, because I think that there is, in my view, a misconception about this right to reimbursement, because I don't think that that's what the court's talking about or has done at all. What the court recognized in Griffin and Gandy and in other cases is an insurer has a right, indeed an insured has a right, to litigate whether or not their policy provides coverage under certain circumstances. I think that that's a given. All right, and the court says in Gandy and Griffith, you should do that early if you can. And the court recognizes you can't in all circumstances do that. Sometimes there are a lot of reasons that you might not be able to, but sometimes you can't get the coverage determination made before the underlying case is ripe for settlement. That's what happened in this case. That's what happened in the Matagorda County case. The right to litigate coverage was there. The right to litigate coverage had not been brought to fruition before the critical moment comes up in the underlying case. Now, the question is, what happens? Why is it that right to litigate coverage is somehow lost because an insured demands settlement, an insured negotiates a settlement, demands that its insurance company fund the settlement, and then takes advantage of that settlement when it is made with the express condition we're going to continue to take the non-coverage position and we are going to exercise our right, continue to exercise our right, which this court has acknowledged exists.
Who determines when a case is ripe for settlement?
That's determined by the factors in the underlying case.
Well, isn't it the insurer, or is it the insurer who's attempting to dictate when a settlement should be made?
Well, in the Frank's case, it was the insurer. The insured controlled the defense. Underwriters are excess underwriters. They have no defense obligation. They didn't participate in the defense. They didn't control the settlement negotiations. They were told, we've got a deal by Franks. We've got a deal. We want you to pay it. And if you don't pay it, we're going to hold you liable under espouse.
And you're essentially telling insureds to settle at their own peril, right?
No. All I'm saying is the insured can do one of two things. It can settle or not settle. It controls. Nothing in Franks says that insurers have a right to force them to settle. Can't do that. There's nothing in the opinion that says that. All it says is if an insured decides, I want this case settled, and then makes a demand, or if they don't make a demand and say, instead, we expressly accept that settlement is what we want in this case. Okay, those are two important contingencies. Absolute control of settlement, it rests with the insured. They don't have to settle. But if they decide they do want to settle and the insurer has reserved its rights and said, look, there is a coverage dispute here. And if you want me to settle, you want me to fund your settlement that you've entered into, that's what happened. You want me to fund your settlement, I'll pay the money. But I'm going to continue to exercise my right to litigate whether or not I owed it. And if ultimately I prevail in the right that I have recognized by this court to litigate coverage, if I ultimately prevail, then my remedy is reimbursement. Well, because
that removes the incentive for early settlement. There's that risk hanging over the insurer's head that they can't settle the case because the insurer has a different opinion as to the value of the case. What's the purpose of trying to resolve a case and save costs down the road?
Well, the total control with defending the case rests with the insurer. Total control when...
Well, in theory.
No, no, in practice. This court has
not,
said...
Not when you have this type of result hanging over the insured's head, that they're settling this case at their peril, because under this case, now you can seek reimbursement against them.
Well...
Until the coverage issue is resolved.
You can get reimbursement if the case is covered. If the claim is not covered, I can then, my remedy is I get reimbursement. I get the money back.
Right, but you can also hold your reservation and rights letter forever. So, look, we don't think it's covered. Go settle the case and we'll resolve it later.
Well, if you're suggesting that an insurer would do that in bad faith or in some way to leverage their insured, I don't think, one, that's what happened in Frank's case. There's no suggestion or evidence of that. And two, if, as I said at the outset, if an insurer sets out on a practice that intentionally is designed to prejudice its insured or leverage its insured, there's adequate remedies. There's plenty of law.
How would you ever prove that? I mean, it strikes me that the insurer is incentivized now to settle early within policy limits. It cuts off its defense costs. And I understand there was no duty to defend here, but as a practical matter, in other cases, it cuts off any defense costs. It eliminates any Stowers liability. And it puts all the onus on the insured then to put its resources into the coverage battle. So the insured finds itself not wanting to disagree to the settlement, but then I've got to spend my money fighting a coverage battle down the road, and doesn't that defeat the very purpose of getting insurance in the first place?
Well, why would an insurance company do that? I've read that.
To save defense costs and protect themselves from Stowers liability or bad faith liability.
So you've got a lawsuit that's pending. You're going to settle early before you know anything about liability. The suggestion is you're going to pay too much money, and then you're going to turn around and sue your insurer.
Well, you can settle early.
I have to say, I've represented insurance companies a long time. I don't understand the logic of that. What does that get you?
Well, it gets them no risk exposure on a bad faith claim, and it gets them their money back.
If there's no coverage.
Right.
Well...
But what I'm saying is
why shouldn't they get their money back if there's no coverage?
But the insured's resources are going to go towards fighting the coverage battle down the road.
The insured's resources, if there is no coverage for a claim, the underwriter has a right to litigate that issue of coverage or not.
Mr. Hall, let me ask you a question. Given this scenario where the insured is in charge of litigation, as I read your policy under the assistance and cooperation clause here, they're in charge of settlement, defense of the claim, as you said. And then we go to when you pay on the indemnity policy. We have an indemnity policy,
right.
And that's the next clause, J, when you pay, either after judgment or after settlement. And then the insured, as I read this, makes a claim, and you have 30 days to decide what's covered or not.
Correct.
Now, in your scenario, the way this happened, you're saying that the insured made a demand that you pay early before coverage was determined as provided for by your policy.
Correct.
And your position is they, by making that demand, had to agree to the conditions.
Correct.
Okay, now, the question seems to me like is we have a question of whether we're going to have an implied duty of law or one of fact. And it seems to me like where we are in this case is your policy covers the issue, and the question is one of fact. Was there an agreement or not? Am I missing something on reading your policy and your argument?
I don't think you're missing anything on reading the policy, and I think that is an approach that could lead to the conclusion and an analysis, I think it was embraced by Justice Wainwright, the first opinion, is that there was a deal struck here. There was an agreement. There was an offer.
Okay, well, no, I want to know what your position is.
I agree with that. I think that there was, in fact, a condition that was placed on the funding of the settlement. The insurer
let me stop you, Jerry. So if that funding was not made, then you had the right under your policy to wait for Franks to settle, come to you, and then litigate the coverage?
Yes.
Okay. So why then, if in fact we talk about two different aspects here, one implied in law right of reimbursement, one an implied in fact. Now, if we are covered under the policy, why would we need to go to an implied in law right of reimbursement?
Well, again, I don't think that the right is to reimbursement. The right is to contest and litigate and get an adjudication of is it covered or not.
And you and have then, that. You have that in your policy.
Well, it's not in the policy. This court recognizes that there is a right implied at law to contest and litigate whether or not contracts.
Whether you had coverage. Whether you had coverage.
Correct.
And your policy doesn't, and I thought we just went over that, your policy provides that if there's a settlement by Franks, the way it's structured, you don't pay until after a judgment or a settlement. Then they make a claim to you, and you have 30 days to decide whether it's covered or not.
Well, that's the feature of an indemnity policy. That's what
involves your policy, in this case, that's the way it works.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But the point I'd like to reiterate is the right that's being exercised here is the right to litigate coverage. If you litigate coverage and you can get it concluded before the moment a settlement comes in the underlying case, then the remedy is you don't have to pay if you are correct on coverage. But if you can't get it concluded before the underlying case is ripe for settlement, then your remedy, if you have agreed to fund, and it's agreed by the insured, and you've agreed and you put that condition on it that you're going to seek reimbursement, then
and if they accept,
and they accept the benefit of the bargain and take the money, then the only way that you can have a remedy if you get a ruling that there was no coverage is to say they get the money back. That it's not a right to reimbursement that's being enforced. It is, in fact, the litigation of the coverage DJ and the right reimbursement is the remedy.
There's a difference between reimbursement and coverage, though.
I agree with that. But the right to litigate coverage is meaningless in the context of this situation where the insurer has funded with the reservation and the express notice of an intent to litigate coverage and get reimbursement if they are correct about their non-coverage position. That's a meaningless, hollow right, unless if they prevail, they can get their money back.
Any further questions?
One other question, Chief. Was there a benefit to excess by settling during trial? Were there benefits, I should say?
Sure. I mean, I think that the excess underwriter by settling eliminated some potential for bad faith if that was there. I mean, you know, bad faith is a difficult thing. It's a reasonableness. It's a very subjective thing. I think all insurers like to get that out of the way if they can do that. And so there was that benefit. There was the benefit that instead of having to pay if they lost 7.5, their policy went up to 10 million. So they could have had to pay a little bit more money even without the aura of bad faith. So there was benefit for them. There was also benefit for the insured. There was benefit for the third-party injured plaintiff. Everybody else in this equation benefited and wanted that money to change hands.
So if you litigate coverage after the fact and then have a reimbursement as a remedy, does the insured get a credit for the benefit to excess that it obtained by paying the settlement during the trial?
Well, I don't see why there would be a credit. I mean, there's no coverage. The insured gets a benefit. Both parties enter that agreement getting a benefit. The insurer gets the same benefit. They could have been exposed to an excess of $7.5 million. They could have been exposed to an excess of 10. There could have been all kinds of problems that had happened for them if they continue to litigate their trial. So both go into that agreement getting a benefit. At the end of the day, as this court said in the majority opinion, the decision of who bears the responsibility to pay for a claim should depend on whether it's covered or not. And the Franks case in opinion allows that to happen. Thank you.
Court is ready to hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Warren Harris will present argument for this.
Mr. Harris, there's a lot of comment on ripe for settlement. Who makes that determination?
Whenever it's ripe, the demand starts with the plaintiff. The plaintiff makes the demand. That's what triggers Stowers.
But does the insurer truly have that decision-making process when the insurer is dictating to them that there may not be coverage and not to settle the case for whatever reason?
Well, the insurer should be making an early resolution of the coverage dispute. That's where this starts. It all starts with the insurer sending a reservation of rights letter. It claims coverage can't be determined under the policy it wrote. It claims it has arguments as to why there's no coverage, and it should make that decision early on. And this court has said that we want to promote early resolution of coverage disputes so that that issue can be resolved before you get to the settlement demand being made by the plaintiff. That's why it should be promoted to happen early on.
The claims were covered here?
I'm sorry, Doug.
Were the claims covered here?
The trial court and the declaratory judgment action found they were not.
And then was that issue appealed?
That was not appealed. There were several summary judgments filed on the coverage issue. The appeal was taken before I was counsel in the case, but there was a lot of confusion with the orders. Reimbursement was originally allowed. Then this court's decision in Matagorda County.
So just as a matter, just as a fact, I mean, and I'm not going to get into the legal argument right now, but if we were to reverse course and say there was no right to reimbursement, then the benefit you would have is the payment by excess underwriters in which there is no coverage. I mean, you would get that benefit. The claim is not covered. We can say that. That's conclusive now. It's not been appealed. So you would get the benefit of that.
There was no cross appeal filed, and the answer to your question is yes, Your Honor.
And so how do you defend the windfall in effect that you would get?
It's not a windfall for at least three reasons. First, you look at the fact that excess underwriters also benefited from the settlement. Excess underwriters got at least three benefits, which I think Mr. Hall talked about. They capped the liability under the policy. They cut off any Stowers liability, and it cut off any defense costs. There's also a detriment to the insured if you allow reimbursement, because insurance affects the demands made by plaintiffs. And whenever there's the specter of insurance that exists and the insurer has not gotten an early resolution, the plaintiff's demand is going to be based on the fact that there may be coverage. It's going to reflect that there's coverage. And so the settlement demand comes in at a higher number, and that's the number that the insurer then settles the case for. And further, there's not a windfall because reimbursement is a right that could be placed in the policy. Insurance companies know how to write that clause and put it in the policy. This is a surplus lines policy. It wasn't regulated. They could have put that provision in as a matter of contract. They chose not to do so and are now asking the court to imply that in the contract.
What do you mean when you say it's not regulated?
It's a surplus lines policy.
I heard that.
That my understanding is doesn't go through the Department of Insurance to regulate the forms.
Any of the forms? Any of the language?
Not in this case.
Limited regulation.
I don't know of any I'm not a regulatory lawyer, Judge, but I don't know of any regulation on this policy. This policy is a Lloyd's of London umbrella, excess umbrella, 1971 form. You can go to a form book and find the Lloyd's 71 policy. It's their policy.
Mr. Harris, let me ask you about the policy. There's some question about a consent to settle provision requiring the consent of the insured to settle before excess can settle. Would you address that? I think they reference Clause J that talks about when and how it's to be paid.
That's right, Judge. It's on page 330 of the record. And you were exactly right in the way you described it earlier. This is an indemnity policy. Underwriters only has the obligation to pay once the insured, Franks, makes a payment under the policy. The loss payable clause, Clause J, determines when that needs to be done. And it's when the case goes to judgment or when the insured is the language used in the policy, but when the insured gets a settlement with the plaintiff, then underwriters also have to sign off on it.
Would excess have breached this policy? As I read the record, excess went over and had a conversation, at least during trial, with the plaintiff trying to settle what they deemed may be covered. Would they have breached the policy by settling the whole case or any part of it?
Well, they weren't trying to settle the whole case at that point.
My question is, would they have breached anything in this policy by settling all or part of the case?
There's no provision in the policy for them doing that. I can't say that there's a breach, but the policy doesn't contemplate underwriters paying this in the first instance. And I think that there may have been some obligations breached when they went over and tried to settle two-thirds of the case and leave the insured exposed for the remainder. But under the policy, I don't know that it's an express breach, but the policy just doesn't contemplate it. They went in and did something that's not allowed under the policy, and now they want to get reimbursement, another right that's also not in the policy.
Okay, so under the, do you disagree with the construction earlier that under Clause J, excess had a right to make a coverage determination after Franks settled the case and made a claim?
I absolutely disagree with that. I don't think Clause J has anything to do with that. I think we have to turn to Texas law and who has the burden to get an early resolution.
Okay, well, what does Clause J, how long does underwriters have to pay Franks? First of all, it's an indemnity policy contemplating that Franks would settle the claim?
Contemplating that Franks could settle the claim, and I believe it's 30 days. What it does is says liability under this policy does not attach until the insurer pays the underlying claim. They then have 12 months to make a claim once it is resolved either by a judgment or by an agreement from the insured, the plaintiff in the underlying case, and the insurance company. And then the insurer has 30 days to make that payment under the indemnity provision.
After the claim is made and proven in conformity with this policy. So they apparently waived that when they jumped in, and whether there was an agreement or not, the claim was settled.
Absolutely.
Question to you also, is it a question of fact or for them to come in at this point and litigate?
Well, there is no express agreement. We don't have anything in the contract. We don't have any express agreement. When they first raised the question of reimbursement, there was no response. It was silence, just like in Matagorda County. So there, it can't be implied in fact. And this court reached that exact issue in Matagorda County.
Okay, well, the question I have is this. Did they have the right under the policy to wait and litigate coverage after settlement? Had they chosen to do so?
No, Judge. There's nothing in the policy that gives them that right. And, in fact, the burden is on the insurer under Texas law to do that in advance. There's nothing in the policy that changes the law on that issue. They have the burden to get this issue decided, and they've got a couple of ways they can do it. They can file a declaratory judgment under this court's decision in Gandy and get that issue resolved. The court has said that you want to promote early resolution, and that's exactly what didn't happen here.
Do you think we should postpone liability determinations until that can be that issue can be resolved?
This court has not reached that issue I'm aware of. I don't know that we need to actually go in and study. You're asking, Your Honor, about studying the underlying case?
Yes, I'm saying if there's a coverage dispute, should the rule be that liability determinations just simply must await a coverage determination?
I don't believe there's any need to do that. The insurer has
well, then
the
how else? I mean, you want it to be done early, but if it can't be done early enough, then what?
The insurer has the ability to go in and attempt to get it done, and you're right. In every instance, that won't happen. If they are not able to get it resolved, the insurer has to make the decision that it makes in every case and has made in this state since at least 1929. It has to decide if there's coverage under its policy.
But should it have to do it with the bad faith liability hanging over it? That's the question. And I guess my question is, since it should be, you think it should be done early?
That's right, and this court has said that in Gandy.
And early means ahead of the liability determination.
Early means as soon as you can. In good faith, attempt to resolve it before the underlying claim is resolved.
But why shouldn't it just await? Why shouldn't the liability claim just await that determination?
Because that leaves the uncertainty of whether there is or isn't insurance. An insurance claim
would get resolved. It would get resolved. I mean, then you'd know. Then going into the liability determination, you'd know one way or the other.
So you're saying why shouldn't you just defer the underlying claim?
Yes.
I think that's going to affect the rights of those parties, and I think that that's a public policy issue for the court, whether to stay the underlying claim, but I think that may have some severe ramifications on the abilities of parties to litigate their claims in court.
Yeah, but it could remove the appearance of a windfall in a case like this, correct?
It would give the insurer in most instances, the ability to resolve the coverage issue first, but I think it's also going to have effect on parties in the underlying litigation that may be adverse, and the court's going to have to balance that.
And how's that?
Because it will tell a plaintiff you can't prosecute your case because an insurance company is contesting coverage, and we're going to have to let that run its course.
But then they would also let the plaintiff know that perhaps there's insurance and the case may be worthwhile pursuing.
But the plaintiff's going to know that anyway. The plaintiff's able to get that through discovery. Plaintiffs know that in evaluating cases.
Well, they know that there's a policy, but they don't know if, in fact, coverage has been determined.
They typically, I think, will know of the existence of the coverage dispute, and that's why we need to get it resolved so that everybody knows whether there is or isn't coverage. The plaintiff will be able to determine that. The insurer will be able to determine whether there is or isn't coverage, and everybody is put back on a level playing field. Insurance companies use the uncertainty as leverage.
So, but I'm just trying to be clear. In a case like this one, you wouldn't mind from the position of this case, if the coverage issue had been determined early on.
And that's what should have happened.
You don't have any objection?
No, Your Honor.
There have been some arguments. Sometimes that forces people to take awkward positions. But you think that can be resolved and that's what should happen?
I think it may vary in some cases. There might be some instances where it can't be resolved. In this case, it could have. There were the coverage issues that were prosecuted in the summary judgment were whether the welding was done was Frank's product and whether that constituted completed operations under the endorsement of the policy. Those were legal issues that could have been resolved during the 11-month window between the reservation of rights letter and the settlement of the case.
So there's some concern that the insured is having to use its resources to litigate coverage when it shouldn't have to, and those concerns. But at least in this circumstance, that you don't see that as a problem if the coverage had been litigated early on in the case.
That's right. And if the insurer is not able to get that resolved, the insurer still has the burden, as it has under Texas law for many years, to make that coverage issue. It's in the business of assessing risk and allocating risk. It's its insurance policy, and it's its arguments that it's having to address. The insurer has the burden.
There's no question that your client did not pay for the coverage the amount that was paid on its behalf.
That's what was ultimately determined in the declaratory judgment.
So, and as I understand the circumstances, your client had $1 million retainage, $1 million underlying policy, is that right?
I don't remember the $1 million retainage. It was $1 million underlying this policy. There may have been some retainage, but I don't think it was that high.
And then excess paid the $7.5 million on top of that.
$7.5 million total, which included underlying.
The total was $7 million.
That policy was partially exhausted through defense cost. I think about half of the underlying claim, underlying policy.
So we're talking about roughly $5 million of coverage that your client paid for. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You think that's fair?
It's fair when you look at all the circumstances. You can't take the isolation of whether there is or isn't coverage. We're now looking at whether there's a right to reimbursement, but you have to look at all the circumstances in doing that. They could have put a reimbursement provision in the policy.
Well, I know all that. But having made the demand for them to pay that, knowing that there was a coverage issue, and now resisting the notion that they should have to pay for that.
They knew there was a coverage issue. They knew it hadn't been resolved, and they hadn't made an attempt to resolve it. They knew in settling the case they were going to get a benefit from this. And by settling the case, it also changed the dynamics because you have the specter of insurance sitting over the situation where the parties don't know whether there is or isn't insurance coverage whenever they settle the case without that issue resolved. That is a harm to the insured, because it changes the demand of the plaintiff. To give you a hypothetical example, you take an insured that has $1 million net worth, and there's a claim that's worth $2 to $3 million. Let's suppose there's a $5 million umbrella policy laying on top of that claim. The claim of the plaintiff is going to vary depending on whether there is or isn't coverage. If there's only $1 million in possible assets from the defendant, that case cannot settle for $2 or $3 million without insurance coverage. If there's insurance coverage, then it's going to be a different dynamic. If the insurer sits on its rights and doesn't get that claim resolved, the parties don't know whether there is or isn't coverage. What's the demand from the plaintiff going to look like? You look at the amicus brief filed by Shell, Temple Inland, Burlington Resources. insurance affects the demand, insurance affects settlement. That's going to come in the $2 to $3 million range, maybe a little under that, depending on the liability facts.
Without insurance, of course, the payment would be $1 million, because that's all you had.
Probably less than that, because that's assuming if it's a business, you basically hand the keys to the business to the plan.
And, of course, nobody wants to own the business. They just want the money.
That's right.
So why wouldn't the same thing happen here? If the insurance company says, okay, we'll pay the $2 million or $3 million, we'll come back and ask for the $1 million or less than $1 million, whatever could be agreed on, that you would have paid anyway.
Well, it's a different dynamic. In the second scenario, you're assuming you're going to pay every nickel of net worth. That's probably not going to happen in a settlement. It is going to come in at some amount under that. And if the plaintiff doesn't, the plaintiff's got to litigate liability. The plaintiff's got to litigate damages. But once the case is settled, those are fixed. The amount of the possible settlement or the amount of the judgment's fixed. At that point, it's only litigating the insurance coverage issue. And once that happens, the insurance company has a judgment. And it's enforcing a $2 or $3 million judgment. They can get all of your non-exempt assets at that point.
What risks are assumed by the insured under your scenario? It seems to me all the risk falls upon the insurer. Is that the way it ought to be?
The burden that's put on the insurer is to decide coverage and to get an early resolution when it disputes coverage. It's not strictly liable for making a wrong decision. The insurer, when faced with the Stowers demand, has to act as a reasonable insurer would. If the insurer is wrong in that circumstance, it's not going to be strictly liable, and the same under a bad faith claim. It needs to act reasonably in deciding whether there is or isn't coverage.
What do you think about...
There's no risk to the insurer.
There is no risk to the insurer?
Insured.
There is risk to the insurer because if the insurer accepts the settlement at that amount that contemplates insurance, it's going to be asked to respond to a significantly higher judgment.
The lawyer for the insured is going to say, let's say the lawyer makes that determination and agrees there's no coverage. I've analyzed this and I don't believe there's coverage at all. But I think you should make a demand to your insurance company to settle this because that's going to put them, if we change our decision, that's going to put them to, you know, this dilemma. Either they pay it or they risk bad faith. And there's some, I think there's no coverage, but there's some uncertainty. There's enough uncertainty that we can, that I'm instructing you or I'm advising you to make a demand when I'm telling you there's no coverage. That seems just a little perverse. When it's clear to you there's no coverage, make a demand under the policy, which really doesn't exist, and put the pressure on them to make a decision.
Your Honor, the first assumption there is that you've shifted the burden to make that decision to the insured, which is going to require the insured, who's represented by insurance, by the counsel hired by the insurer, to get coverage counsel to come in and make those determinations, when it should be the insurer make those determinations. And it's usually far from clear whether there is or isn't coverage. This is not a case where it was crystal clear that there was no coverage. The insurance company was offering $5 million.
It was a summary judgment that you didn't appeal.
But during the settlement...
That's about as clear as it gets it.
Well,
these kinds of things, isn't it?
Judge, I'm not exactly sure why it wasn't appealed, but during the settlement, the insurance company was offering $5 million to settle the claim. And if it was clear that there was no insurance, they would not have been offering $5 million out of their own pocket if they thought truly there was no insurance. The insurance company settled this case because they thought there was a real risk that there was insurance for at least a substantial portion of the claim. If you look at the settlement correspondence, they were saying that there is one provision that might not be covered dealing with the debris removal. That was what they were really asserting, and that's why they offered to pay two-thirds of the claim.
Is it fair to say that before this case, insurance companies never sought reimbursement from their insureds, and that this changes the whole dynamic of the settlement process?
Before this case, insurers did not have the ability to do that. If the insurers, as underwriters did in this case, under a coverage dispute, paid the settlement, the case was over.
Well, and that's my question. I mean, was that always the case? Was that the practice in the industry, or were insureds kicking in money to avoid any sort of reimbursement claim?
Insurers would use the coverage dispute as leverage to attempt to get a contribution. We see that from the Shell amicus brief. We see that from the roundtable discussion we filed with the court. That's what's going on in real life from the practicalities, is they are attempting to get contributions, but ultimately, if they either get a small contribution or get no contribution, the insurer had to make that decision. It had to decide whether there was or wasn't coverage, act reasonably and pay the claim, or don't pay the claim if there's no coverage. If there's no coverage, there's absolutely no exposure.
Any further questions?
Yes, sir. One more, maybe two. Would you address the concern that have been raised by attorneys in amicus briefs that the implied at law approach raises a conflict or puts them in a conflict position?
TADC, I think, does a great job of laying that out in its letter brief. And basically, whenever there's a reservation of rights letter filed and there's a coverage dispute, that puts counsel for the insurer, the insurance defense counsel, in a real box of deciding what to do. You get a demand in from the plaintiff. Do you forward that demand? Then you're making a demand, and under the court's new rule created, that's going to create a right of reimbursement. Do you say that the settlement's reasonable? If you say it's reasonable, you've created a right of reimbursement. Do you allow your client to consent to the settlement? If you do, you've now created a right of reimbursement. Any of those things can create prejudice to your client because you're in this conflict situation, and doing nothing may not be any better. You get an offer in from the plaintiff, you call the plaintiff and say, send it to the insurance company. I can't get in the middle of this. The insurance company is going to say, you're the lawyer here. Is this a reasonable settlement? We need you to evaluate the case.
A separate counsel can make that determination, right?
Yeah, but that's the that's the whole point. That's what we've seen in some of the amicus briefs. Well, it's not a conflict. They can just hire another lawyer. Well, you're hiring another lawyer because there is a conflict. And that's going to require the insured to now go hire a second lawyer whenever it was paying for a defense under the policy. It was paying for the insurance company to make the decision and to handle the case, to decide settlement, to decide whether there's coverage. And now, any time there's a reservation of rights letter filed, it will require the insured to go hire another lawyer to deal with this conflict.
It's common to hire another lawyer on non-covered issues.
Whenever the declaratory judgment is filed and the case is brought to issue, what often happens is insurance companies will routinely file a reservation of rights letter. Don't know if they're serious about it or not. If they don't file the litigation and don't proceed with it, often it sits there, and then what happens is the underlying case progresses, then a settlement demand is made, then the insurer is saying, well, I filed a reservation of rights letter a year ago, I haven't done anything on it, I now need to decide whether there is or isn't coverage to see if this case ought to be settled. And what the insurer is trying to do now is to alleviate that burden from itself and shift that burden to the insured to say, you ought to be deciding whether there's coverage. You need to make that determination when that burden has always been placed on the insurer before.
Any further questions? Thank you.
I'd like to first address the issue of the defense counsel conflict. This court's made it very clear in Davalos and Travers. If there's an insurance dispute, defense counsel's sole obligation is to the insurer. Period. End of story. That's what they have to do, and this court's been very clear about that. The Franks case in case does not say that if defense counsel evaluates the case and says that a demand has been made, it's reasonable, that that is, in fact, a demand on the insurer to settle, or that that is, in fact, an express agreement that the settlement ought to occur. It doesn't stand for the proposition that all of the briefs say that it does, which is the proposition required to put somebody in conflict. There is no conflict. The defense counsel represents the interests of the insured. That's clear. The court said that. That's what they have to do. And in evaluating the case, they do what the insurer tells them. If the insurer wants an evaluation, they evaluate it. The evaluation is not going to trigger anything that happened in Frank's case. And I'll submit, it's not what happened in Frank's. It's a completely different case than Frank's.
Although you wouldn't be opposed to removing the Stowers piece of Frank's because that wouldn't affect the decision as far as you're concerned. I mean, that the plaintiff makes a demand and therefore creates a right to reimbursement. There is something sort of perverse about that reasoning, that the plaintiff is the one who can make that determination. You wouldn't mind if that piece of the opinion went away.
The piece of the opinion that the plaintiff makes a Stowers demand?
And that making the Stowers demand that is determined to be reasonable, that the insured wants you to settle for, triggers a reimbursement right.
I don't mind Stowers. As a guy who represents insurers a lot, we've lived with Stowers for a long time. It's fair. I don't have any problem dealing with it.
What I'm talking about is the piece of the opinion that says if the plaintiff sends a Stowers letter and the insured says the Stowers letters come in, settle the case, that somehow the insured has agreed to a reimbursement right. You wouldn't mind that piece of the opinion being gone. Apparently, that has generated a lot of heartache by seeing the amicus briefs, that piece of the opinion.
Well, maybe I can answer it this way. I think it's a case of be careful what you ask for. Because let's take the Franks case in case and apply Matagorda County jury. If Matagorda County had been the law of the land from the day one when Franks gets underway, which it wasn't, Matagorda County opinion came out of this court after Judge Work had already issued a summary judgment in favor of no coverage and the right to get the money back because there was no coverage. But what would have happened in Franks? Lawsuit gets filed. Insurer looks at it. There's a coverage problem. Obviously a coverage problem because ultimately it was held that there was no coverage. They reserve rights. Not only do they reserve rights, under Matagorda County, they've got to file a DJ. And not only do they have to file it, they have to vigorously prosecute it because they've got to try to get it concluded or at least get it to the point where they have enough insight into the coverage issues so that at the time that the underlying case is ripe for resolution, they know better what they want to do. Okay, so now what has happened? The insured is defending the case, and they're litigating coverage. They're fighting on two fronts. I've been in that situation before after this court issued the Matagorda County case.
But Gandy didn't. I mean, Matagorda didn't change that result. I mean, in Gandy, we said push the coverage dispute early.
Gandy said push it when you can and recognize you can't always do it.
But in this case, you could have.
Well, I'm not positive about that. In this case, it was ripe for resolution of summary judgment. Remember, 3 days of trial. So a lot of fact issues had been already developed. And the issues that were involved in were products and completed ops exclusions. That requires some development of facts in order for the court to make the legal determination of no coverage. You've got to have some underlying basis of uncontested fact to reach that resolution.
Which is the purpose of discovery.
Correct. And so that's what would have happened, and the case would have been litigated, if I continue with the scenario. All right, so you're insured in two different lawsuits now. And then, eventually, the underlying lawsuit gets ripe for some type of settlement negotiation, or they go to trial. And so they then come, and Franks takes the same position that they took in this case. We want you to settle. We're not going to agree to anything. We just want you to pay the money. We've got a deal done. You pay, end of story. Well, if Matagorda County is the law of the land, the insurer is going to say, I'm not doing that. You're on your own. You know, let's continue our coverage DJ. I've got a right to do that, and that's what we're going to do. And they continue the coverage DJ. In that circumstance, the injured party doesn't get paid. Franks is litigating on two different fronts, and I would submit that it really is better to have it happen the way it happened in Franks.
Mr. Hall, let me ask, if I might, Chief, ask one question. You indicated that you were, as an insurance defense lawyer, I take it, not uncomfortable with Stowers.
Correct.
How about bad faith?
Well, I'm not uncomfortable with the law of bad faith. I mean, an insurer has to act responsibly and reasonably and deal with its insurance in good faith. And a lot of the briefs that are filed say all kind of horrible things are going to happen because insurance companies aren't going to do that. Well, I think if they don't do that, they're going to have trouble on their hands. And I think that, you know, insurance companies don't, as a general proposition, mind having to deal with their insurers in the way this court has said they have to, which is a good thing.
Do you agree that reimbursement provisions can be put in these types of policies without regulatory approval?
Yes.
In Texas?
Yes. It is an excess of surplus lines policy, and to answer your prior question, it is regulated, but not as vigorously as admitted carriers are regulated. So there's some things that have to be put in the policy, but there is a lot more freedom of negotiation. The question I would ask is, why do you do that and where do you draw the line? You don't have to put in the policy that I have a right to file a DJ. You don't have to put those kinds of things because it's obvious you can do that. And so if you start putting into contracts, trying to anticipate all different permutations that might arise and saying how you're going to deal with it, one, I think it's impractical and impossible. And two, the court's already recognized the right to litigate coverage. And as I said earlier, that's the right, is to litigate the rights and obligations under the policy. And then the question is, if you win, what happens? And if you've already paid the money, and you've paid it with the notice and the reservation, the only thing that can put the parties back to where they ought to be, i.e., that the money that was paid to settle the claim comes from the insurer, it's not court, is to say that there's a reimbursement.
There's been so much discussion about this opinion. Surely you recognize that the fact that there's a reimbursement right out there now that's broader than Matagorda County has caused a lot of people a lot of discussion, some heartache, some enthusiasm. So if that provision is brought up to be put in a policy, it's going to affect the reasonable actors sitting at a table negotiating rates. Certainly you recognize that.
I'm not an underwriter. I would suspect that's
going to at least enter into the negotiations.
Yes.
So it's not just following course. It is a difference. Good or bad, it's a difference.
It would be a difference in the policies. I don't think it's required to have that in the policies, though, for this. This is a remedy this court's already embraced.
But it would affect the premium paid.
It may or it may not. I mean, I think generally premiums are affected less by those kinds of conditions and more by market conditions and whether there's been a storm in the Gulf and other things like that. That has a much, much bigger impact than this kind of provision does.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. The clause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.